get started. Let me pray for us as we begin. Father, we thank you for this time. We thank you for time to again consider how we know you, how we know everything that we know, how we can grow in that, how our relationship to you connects both with our faith and trust in you and also the things that we know. We pray that you would help us in this time to grow a bit in wrestling through those questions and thinking them through and in discussing them together. So we pray for your blessing on this time in Christ's name. Amen. All right. I'm going to start with sort of a disclaimer, which is it's usually not good when someone starts with excuses when they're doing a lesson. But we came in from Yakima yesterday, and I felt I haven't had as much time to put this together as I'd like. So hopefully it'll still go well. But but I'm feeling a little under the weather, and as I said, so basically, if anything seems not quite organized or not quite perfect or totally fine-tuned, assume that, you know, feeling a little bit better and having a little more time, it would have just been the most amazing Sunday school you've ever heard. Generally, just assume that. But there's circumstances that cause it to be off a little bit. So anyway, with that said, this is the last lesson in the series we've been doing on postmodernism, looking at different aspects of it. And what I'm hoping we'll do today is to bring some of the stuff together. We've done a lot of the postmodern critique, especially the last 3 weeks. We spent a week looking at the history, some aspects of the history of thought that got us to postmodernism, to this stage in thinking. We looked at three thinkers. We looked at Derrida, we looked at Foucault, we looked at Lyotard, and looked at each of their critiques that they were bringing to a modernist concept of knowledge. So asking from a bunch of different angles how we know what we know, what kind of confidence we have, where faith comes in, things like that. What I'm hoping to do today is to, instead of just critiquing, to put forward a little more of a positive picture of how we relate to knowledge, how we can have confidence in what we know. And so that's the goal for today. We'll see how successful it is. I've mentioned this each week. These are the three main sources I've used for this series. James Smith is a philosopher at Calvin College. Peter Leithart has also done work on postmodernism. And then Joel Garver. A lot of the stuff for today, though, is also drawing from a book by N.T. Wright. Actually, one chapter of a book by N.T. Wright. In his book, The New Testament and the People of God, he has a chapter, chapter 2. It's not called Critical Realism, but that's where he puts forward critical realism, this approach to knowledge. And it's helpful. N.T. Wright has this series of thick books on getting at the historical nature of the Christian faith and what really happened in the first century. And so in chapter 2 of that series, he helpfully points out, you know, we don't really have a lot of consensus anymore on how we can have confidence on things and how we can know things and what causes us to change our minds. We actually need to talk a little bit about the philosophy of how we know what we know, or else I could put all these facts out there and you could just shrug them off. So he spends a chapter on that, and it's a helpful discussion. It's one that we talked I was first exposed to in seminary, and so he calls it critical realism. I'm going to call it a few different things, but this is one of the other main sources that I'm pulling from. So there's three main categories we're going to look at, three categories of thought on how we know things, how we have confidence in them. We've talked a lot about modernism and postmodernism in earlier lessons. I'm going to branch out the postmodernism category into two now, basically. So we have modernism. That's one approach. We're going to look at that and talk about it a little bit. But all of the, all of the resources I mentioned earlier, a lot of people who are wrestling with these questions have been showing two different categories of what has been called, usually in a simplistic way, postmodernism. One, that James Smith calls it quasi-postmodernism. He actually argues that it would be better to call it hypermodernism. He argues it's actually more of an intensification of modernism than it is a real response to modernism. But I'm going to use the term quasi-postmodernism for that. And one of the things we're going to see, I think, is as we look at that, it will start to look familiar, and that it's usually at a popular level what's just called postmodernism. When we think of postmodernism, we often think of what James Smith would like us to call quasi-postmodernism. And the other category is what we're going to call thorough postmodernism. this has been more in line with some of the stuff we've been looking at, both the thinkers and also being a little bit more consistent in the postmodern critique of modernism. Leithart calls it deep postmodernism. N.T. Wright, there's a lot of overlap. What he's doing is not, I don't think, identical with what Smith is doing, but it's close enough that I'm kind of going to just jam them together for this lesson. And he talks about critical realism. So I'm going to try to just use these three terms that I have on the top, talk about modernism, quasi-postmodernism, and thorough postmodernism as the three ways that we're going to look at knowledge and how we can know what we know. So, the question I want to ask, and the way I want to approach it, is to ask what conversion is. What does it mean to convert from one way of looking at the world to another? Another way we could rephrase that is just, how do we decide what is true? A lot of the past few lessons have been about how, as modernists and with some of the modernist tendencies we might have absorbed by osmosis, we can be overconfident in our knowledge of certain facts. But the question is then, how do we know what is true? How can we have confidence? How do we know that my way of looking at the world as a Christian is a more accurate way of looking at the world than a Muslim or a secularist would, instead of we're just each choosing what we prefer? So I want to look particularly at the process of conversion, at what goes on when someone changes their mind and their worldview. And I actually want to use an illustration from The Matrix to do that, to watch a clip from that. It's a little bit of a longer clip. It's about 8 minutes, which is a lot of time, I know, but I think it's helpful. I want us to look at some process where someone goes through a conversion where their worldview has a radical shift. I think we can get a little stuck when we think of conversion in religious terms, which is, you know, in terms we want to talk about it in, but it's so familiar we sometimes have trouble looking at the different pieces of it, looking at the process itself. What's helpful about the conversion in this clip is that it's fairly foreign to us. How many people have seen this movie or seen parts of it? So I'm just going to set it up for you a little bit. It's a sci-fi movie. It's pretty weird. Again, I'm hoping that's one of the benefits and not doesn't end up being a distraction, but we'll see. Neo, who's played by Keanu Reeves, is this guy. He has a computer programming job. He's sort of a normal guy. He lives in 1999 and, you know, has sort of a uneventful life. And he meets these people, and they lead him down this path. They start talking to him. There's this thing called the Matrix. He's not sure what it is. Something's wrong with the world. And he decides he wants to know what it is. He makes this decision, yeah, I want to understand what you guys are talking about. And they hook him up to some machines, they give him a pill, and he wakes up all of a sudden in this bizarre world where he looks around and there's all sorts of people hooked up in pods. It's very strange. We're not going to watch that part. This is the lead up there. They scoop him up from there, they bring him on board this ship, and he wakes up, he recovers, and now he has no idea what's going on. He's completely disoriented, and he asks them, you know, where am I? How did you get me here? What's going on? And that's the clip that that we're going to look at. What I want us to think about is to just pay attention to what's going on, what's the process that leads Keanu Reeves' character, Neo, to change the way he views the world. How does Morpheus talk to him? What are the things that are going on? So we're going to look at this, and then I'm going to back up. We're going to talk about the categories, and we'll come back to this again to sort of illustrate what's going on. So, all right, let me go ahead and get that going.
This is the world as it exists today. For certain is that at some point in the early 21st century, all of mankind was united in celebration. We marveled at our own magnificence as we gave birth to AI,
an artificial intelligence,
a singular consciousness that spawned an entire race of machines. We don't know who struck first, us or them, but we know that it was us that scorched the sky. Time, they were dependent on solar power, and it was believed that they would be unable to survive without an energy source as abundant as the sun. Throughout human history, we have been dependent on machines to survive. Fate, it seems, is not without a sense of irony. The human body generates more bioelectricity than a 120-volt battery and over 25,000 BTUs of body heat. Combined with a form of fusion, the machines had found all the energy they would ever need. There are fields, endless fields, where human beings are no longer born. We are grown. For the longest time, I wouldn't believe it. And then I saw the fields with my own eyes. Watched them liquefy the dead so they could be fed intravenously to the living. And standing there, facing the pure, horrifying precision, I came to realize the obviousness of the truth. What is the Matrix? Control. The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world, built to keep us under control in order to change a human being into this.
No. I don't believe it. It's impossible.
I didn't say it would be easy to you. I just said it would be the truth.
Stop. Let me out. Let me out. I want out. Easy. Can I?
No. But if you could, would you really want to? I feel like...
I'm going to stop it there. Okay. So that's a little dark. But it gives, I think, what I'm hoping will be as we move on in this and as we look at this a little more closely, a helpful picture of a conversion, a radical shift in worldview that happens with the main character. We want to think about how what happens for him in one sense, thinking about he thinks he lives in 1999 and he actually lives in 2199, and his whole life he's been hooked up to a computer and it's been a dream world, and it's this radical shift of worldview. That's what he was having there. We're going to look at how he went through that process, but we're going to back up first and look at those three different models, really, for how conversion works. It's going to be somewhat simplified, but I'm hoping it'll be helpful nonetheless. So we'll back up from that. We'll come back to it in a minute. I want to look at, as I said, the three categories. So for modernism, again, simplifying a good bit, but for modernism, the way that we have a conversion, the way that we decide what is true, is essentially an act of construction. We might abandon one worldview and then we build another one from scratch. I mean, this is essentially what the Modernist Project was. It was, let's take a step back, let's doubt everything, and let's try to reconstruct a way of understanding the world from the ground up. Quasi-postmodernism, that other category I mentioned earlier, the one that we're going to also be critiquing, a conversion is more of a shift in a mirror. This is more what we tend to associate with terms like relativism, where what we believe is true, what we think is true about the world, what we believe about spirituality is really just a self-reflection. We're really looking in a mirror. It's really about what's true for us. And so if we switch what we believe is true, it's more of a shifting in our self-understanding, a shifting in the way that we look at things than it is really finding new information and building something something solid on it. So we'll talk about that one. And then the third one that we're going to look at, thorough postmodernism or critical realism, is what I'm calling an informed leap of faith. that we move from one faith-based story to another. We talked about that a few weeks back with Ligatar, how the foundation we stand on when we understand the world is a story. It's a story we accept ultimately by faith. But it's an informed leap of faith from one story to another when we have conversion based on new data, based on something that leads us to make that leap. Again, simplifying a lot, another way to think about these three categories is that for modernism, they really want to focus on just the facts. All that really matters is the facts. This concept that we can have these pure objective facts and build something with them. For quasi-postmodernism, it's all about faith in a sense of it's what you choose to believe. It's what you choose to have faith in. But what, you know, believe in something, and that's what's true for you. Thorough postmodernism wants to have both the reality of facts that we can know about the world and also the component of faith. It wants to take both of those things seriously and think about how they interact with each other. So let's start with modernism, looking at that construction model. So you start out with modernism, and this is going to be a little bit familiar. We've done this, if you've been in some of the earlier lessons, we've done this a little bit. And what you start standing on is this foundation of autonomous universal reason. You've got this way of reasoning about the world, of seeing the world that all human beings share, and we start with that. And then we look out on the world, and we see information. We see things about the world. We see data, basically. And so we stand on reason, we can evaluate the data that way, we perceive the data by looking at it, and once we've got it, we need to start constructing a worldview. And it's essentially what it is, it's an act of construction. We take a lot of data, and we build it up piece by piece, and eventually this piece that we're seeing right here is going to fit somewhere in that structure. It's going to be one of the bricks that goes in as we're building our understanding of the world. And so that's sort of an ongoing project for that view, for modernism. This is what we're working on. There are three, you could make this a little more succinct. I think it's helpful to tease it out to three, but there are three tenets that are going on, three concepts that are going on in this approach. We've talked about these again a little bit earlier. One is that the idea that we can have objective certainty about things. Again, we talked about objectivity in this sense is pure access. We're not interpreting, we're not working things through with language, we just have a pure access to the way things are. And we can have that. That's the first piece of modernism when it comes to knowledge. The second one is that only those things we can know objectively and certainly are real knowledge. Those are the only things that are really reliable. Those are the only things we can all agree on and that are worth really putting your trust in. And the third, which is sort of a consequence of that, is that anything that's outside of this objective certainty of this rational and often scientific analysis is unknowable or nonsensical. Again, this is simplifying, but it's in a different category. It's something, you know, you can believe what you want to and I'll believe what I want to about God, but we can all agree about these other things that are objective. So these are the concepts that are going on as we're working through this. So then we have the postmodern critique. And this is what we've been doing the past 3 weeks. So if we're looking at this model, we have a few different critiques that come in. One, as we talked about Derrida three lessons back, Derrida talked about how everything is interpretation. The idea is that we can't just see something and experience it directly. We're always interpreting. Everything that we see in the world is an interpretive process going on. And so our vision isn't just this direct connection. It's something where we have to interpret it, where we're seeing it through a certain lens. So Derrida would come and see that that component is oversimplistic. Lyotard will then look at autonomous universal reason and question whether that's something that exists. Again, that's something we looked a couple lessons back and said, you know, we're all starting with a faith-based story. There's not an autonomous universal reason. I'm kind of going through these fast. If you weren't here for those lessons, I apologize. We just don't have time to kind of go through and rehash them again. And then Foucault just sort of had a general problem with this whole approach to worldview and what we do with data. We looked at, there are a couple different aspects of Foucault. I mentioned briefly how he focused on the way community plays a role in deciding what is real data and what's not, what is real knowledge and what's not. But we also talked about liturgy a lot in that lesson. And one of the things we considered was how community and how ritual play a large role in shaping our worldview. It's not just this cold intellectual process of we sit down with the data and we build it into a system that makes sense. But the way that we view the world, what our understanding of the world is shaped by rituals, it's shaped by stories, it's shaped by community. And so this way, again, of constructing Foucault has a critique for that. So we've done this postmodern critique. We've looked at the different aspects and seen a variety of problems with it. And so what I would argue, is that we have issues with the modernist approach to knowledge. That's not really going to work for us. So that's the first one, the modernist approach. Does anyone want to say anything about that or ask any questions before I go on to the next one? There's a lot of that underlying, a lot of scientific assumptions. It's interesting, and we've talked about that, in some of the earlier lessons, shifts in philosophy of science and, thinking through, what we can know. It's one of the things one of the examples we'll look at is related to that, too. But, a lot of, especially not just, it's helpful to distinguish, things we can know through science, but also a worldview that's shaped by science. One of the, someone had recommended using the term scientism or trying to come up with another label for that, but the worldview that says what we can really know about is just what we can know through science and we can build something on that is very much part of the modernist project. So, that's the way. Yeah.
It seems a bit overly simplistic because, Nietzsche, who I don't think you can categorize as a modern, to do essentially the same thing, just abandon the entire Judeo-Christian movie, build everything from scratch, philosophical Superman.
I agree. It's oversimplistic. It's sort of a struggle of trying to bring this, fit this in a.
I guess what I'm saying is it's not just modernity that drives that. There's many postmodern philosophers.
They still start rebuilding the same way, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. Yeah. We talked about that. I think the most helpful way to look at that is this idea of having pure access to the way things really are. So, and that's where I'm using shorthand because we did we spent a chunk of time on this, and it's hard to, at least hard for me, to put it out there again without spending a lot of time on it. But the idea that we can have direct access to things and we can know it without any doubt, that there's no role that interpretation is playing in the process. So there can be an attempt to want to separate out what we can objectively know and what's subjective. What is sort of obvious, we can look at it and know it and experience it, and what we're interpreting with language. We talked about modernism. A lot of it in its theory of knowledge is relying on this concept that we can know things that way, that we can have this objective, direct knowledge. So one of the distinctions I made, too, is that we often use the word objective in a lot of different ways. So it's frequently used to just say this corresponds to something out there that's real. To say something is objectively true means, there's a reality to it. So we use it that way, and in that sense, we would not, as Christians, deny objectivity in any way, if that's the way that we were using it, or someone was using it. So that concept, there's still a connection between what we know and what's out there in the world. It's more whether we have a direct access to that thing, or whether it's mediated through language and community and our own thought process. That's the thing that we're getting at. Is that helpful at all, or? Okay. All right. Let me look at quasi-postmodernism here, and I think this, at least for me, was a helpful distinction of what's going on in a lot of what is called postmodernism. So for quasi-postmodernism, we have the person, and they're standing on this worldview story that's accepted by faith. That's their starting point. And this worldview is not just something that's under them, it's something that we're always looking through. So we look through this lens of a worldview that's going to shape the way that we see other things. So we look through it, and so far, what I'm going to put forward with thorough postmodernism, I think I would be on board with this so far, and this is where it gets a little bit sketchy. Because then there's a lot of thought about what this worldview lens really does. And we feel like we see data, we feel like we're experiencing a world out there, that there's things that we can really access and know. But quasi-postmodernism starts to question, I'm going to give the reasons why in a minute, but starts to question whether we can really see those things. Can we really rely, at all that those things are out there? Can we believe that? And it starts to ask if really what's going on here is that we're just seeing our own reflection. Everything that we see, the way we interpret the world, is just a reflection of ourselves. We're reflecting us, we're reflecting our worldview that we've already accepted by faith. And so instead of being a lens, this starts to function more like a mirror. It looks like we're seeing a world out there. It looks like there's things we can know, but really, it's all relative. It's what we think is true. It's what we I don't even know if we want to use the phrase choose to believe, but it's a reflection of what our community believes, what we believe, and we continue to reinforce it and to believe those things. Smith is helpful on this point because he points out that if we go back to those tenets of knowledge from modernism, the mistake that's made here is in actually being too modern, in a sense. So we have these three concepts that come from a lot of forms of modernism, and quasi-postmodernism rejects this first one, this idea that we can have objective certainty about some things. That's what the lens is there. It's saying we're always looking through a lens, we're always interpreting. So it acknowledges that first one. But instead of continuing to go down the list, it basically stops there. And if anything, it sort of doubles down on the other two. So it says, well, we can't have this objective, direct access to the world. We're always interpreting. We have a story we're told as children about the world. We have assumptions that we always bring to the table. There's all these this subjectivity in the process. So we can't really see things objectively. But we're going to maintain, as a lot of the modernist movement did, that only objective certainty is real knowledge. And that anything outside of that category isn't real knowledge. And so what you're left with is essentially saying we can't have any real knowledge. We can't know these things with the certainty that we'd like to, and therefore we're losing faith in the idea that we can know them at all. This is, again, like I said, a lot of what we would refer to as relativism. So these things start to reflect back. And the issue is really at that point of what's happening when we're looking at things with assumptions. Can we have assumptions and still actually see the world out there, even if it's shaped in part by those assumptions? And in a very, again, I'd say a very modernist move, this sort of quasi-postmodernism says, if we're really using any lens, then there's not any real sight. We can't trust it enough to think that we can really have confidence in it. So if there's no certainty, there's no confidence in our knowledge about the world. And this, again, as I said, is a lot of what is usually labeled. I think often as Christians, as we struggle through this is what we see on a popular level a lot of the time. And so this is what's labeled as postmodernism. What Smith and Lightheart and others want to point out is that there's really two categories going on here, not one. So this is the quasi-postmodernist approach. That ends in a sort of relativism. A fairly thorough relativism, I guess. So I want to look at the third one now, look at thorough postmodernism, and look at those tenets again. We said with modernism, we had these three concepts going on for the most part. Again, in a simplistic way, we're looking at this. I'm trying to get the major categories in there. But we have these three concepts. Quasi-postmodernism is going to knock out the first one. It's going to see a lot of those critiques we talked about, but it's going to hold on to the other two. What a thorough postmodernism would do instead is to knock all of those out, to knock those modernist views of knowledge out, and replace it with the idea, as we said in that first one, we can't have objective certainty. We can't see things. This is really another way, and a few people have pointed this out, hopefully, this is really a way of saying we can't see things the way God sees them. God sees things directly. God has an all-knowing way of looking at the world, and it is as he sees it. But as creatures, as being finite in our knowledge and finite in what we can see and what we can experience, we were not made to view the world the exact same way God does. We don't have the same type of knowledge. And so we don't have objective certainty. We're always interpreting. However, we can still have real knowledge even without that certainty, even outside of a sort of mathematical certainty, we can have real knowledge. This is a taking serious of a lot of other forms of knowledge. So one way to illustrate it, I think, is you think about the difference in knowledge of, what the freezing point of water is, and whether or not your spouse loves you. There's very different parts to those two pieces of knowledge. They're not just the same thing, and yet both are knowledge. We want to affirm that you can know that your spouse loves you or your child loves you, even if there's no way to objectively prove it. You can't have some sort of certain proof that you could show to someone, and there it is, that's certain proof that your child loves you, but you still have it as real knowledge. So there's a broader acceptance of what knowledge is and what it can be. So if we're looking at it with the thorough postmodernism, we start in a lot of ways like we did with the quasi-postmodernism. But there's a view that we really are seeing through the lens. It's shaped by the lens. It's not a clear and perfect view, but we're looking through a lens. It's being shaped some, but we are seeing things that are out there. We have access to the world that's out there. And then with the question of how does conversion happen, how do we change our view, and again, this is drawing a lot from critical realism, from N.T. Wright stuff, is that when we see that data is actually capable of critiquing the worldview that we started with. It's capable of looking back on the assumptions we had at the beginning. Our assumptions aren't just things that can never be questioned. And if we think about life, I'm going to give some examples, but when we think about life, this frequently happens. We have certain presuppositions about the world, but new data, new information can cause us to take a step back and question those things. So we're able to see the data that's out there, and that data that's out there is able to help us critique our worldview and critique those things. So what happens essentially with conversion, when we shift from one way of looking at the world to another, is that we start with a worldview story that's accepted by faith, and we see a piece of data, and we find that data does not line up with the story that we came with, that we brought to the table, the assumptions we had at the beginning. They're inconsistent. They can both be true. And what happens at that point is there's an alternative worldview that's offered. There's an alternative story of the world that's told and said, you were told it was like this. It's actually like this. And that worldview is considered, and it's compared with the new data maybe and seen that it is consistent. And at that point, the person might determine that it's time to make a leap of faith. It's a leap of faith because he started with something that was accepted by faith. He couldn't prove the story of the world that he began with. And he can't really prove, in a modernist sense, the other view of the world either. He can't sort of make a mathematical certainty about its truth. So there's faith involved, and yet it's informed. It's based on looking at the world. It's based on wrestling with the information available to him. And so that shift is made, and that's essentially what is going on with conversion. Let me bring Neo in now to talk about how we see that with him. So Neo starts with his view of the world. It's 1999, and he's a computer programmer, and life isn't terribly interesting. And he's given this new piece of data, which is, you know, waking up in some sort of strange, bizarre world where people are hooked up to machines and in pods and all sorts of weird stuff is happening. And that data does not compute with his belief that he still lives in 1999 in America. And so he has a problem. What's interesting, and this is why I kind of like this, is to think about what Neo doesn't do. I think it helps us look at those other two categories a little more clearly. Neo, his shift, you know, at the end, he seems to have accepted that worldview despite his initial claims that he didn't believe it. When he's lying in bed, he knows that this is true. He's accepted this story. And his conversion, his shift, seems natural in that way. But Neo doesn't start by trying to rebuild the world, his worldview from scratch. He doesn't say, oh, wow, okay, I see my understanding of the world was wrong. I need to just step back, and I'm going to doubt everything, and I'm going to rebuild my knowledge of the world. He doesn't do that. He also doesn't say, wow, I didn't see that coming. So obviously I can have no real knowledge of the world. So this is interesting. Maybe we are hooked up to machines and being used as a power source for, you know, this horrible dystopian robot world. But who knows? You know, we can't really know what's true. I'm not going to do anything about it. He doesn't do that either. Instead, what he does is he leaps to a new story that makes sense of the data he's given. And that's essentially what Morpheus does. Morpheus doesn't line up a whole bunch of arguments. He doesn't start from scratch. He tells a different story about the world. He says, look, this is the story that you believe about the world. Here's some information why I think it doesn't really explain everything. You're probably figuring that out by now. Here's an alternative story of how we got to where we are, of why the world is the way it is, and of what's going on. Here it is. Tell me if that makes sense of things. And Neo's conclusion is that it does. And he makes a leap of faith, and he shifts his view of the world based on that. He shifts from one story to another. And what's helpful, I think, and important is to see that we have both real wrestling with facts, with data, with a thoughtful approach to things, but also a huge component of story and a huge component of faith. It's not that we choose one of those things, but all of those things are interacting together. So the last thing I want to look at, and then we'll see what other thoughts we have, is pulling out of the crazy dystopia robot world and coming back to conversion as we might see it or experience it more, is to ask, what are the pieces of data that do this? What are the things that can cause this in someone's life? There's a lot of ways I think we could categorize that data. I'm using three categories. I'm using it loosely. It's just seemed like a helpful shorthand for me, so there are probably better ways to organize it. But what this data is it's something that shows someone that their current worldview can't really explain reality. There's an inconsistency between this data and what they believe about the world. And I think there's three helpful categories. We could think about those as that is material data. I'll explain what this means. As value-based data or as relational data. The things that have to do with what we commonly call facts about the world, what seems to be true around us. They can be things about what we value in life and how that's consistent or not with our worldview. And then they can be relational things as well. These can all be pieces of data that cause someone to shift in this way. So looking at material data, one of those is Christ's resurrection, the historicity of Christ's resurrection. This is a helpful one, I think, because we started, you know, I said I'm drawing most of my stuff on critical realism of this model from N.T. Wright's work, from the first volume he has in a larger series. But the third volume he has in that series is a very thorough argument for the historicity of Christ's resurrection. And he essentially goes through and says, look, we're going to look at all the different arguments out there. We're going to look at all the different options. And his argument is, when we really look at the historical data, there is no way to explain the birth of early Christianity unless Jesus rose from the dead. It's not even just that most of the facts line up that way. It's just I'm not aware of anyone who has a plausible story that would explain how Christianity got started the way it did unless this actually happened as a historical event. So that's N.T. Wright's argument in that book. And essentially what he's trying to do, essentially how he's using this model, is to say, look, if you he's writing particularly for people outside of the church. He's writing for intellectuals and scholars who are coming from a non-believing worldview, from a modern secular approach to the world. And he's saying, here's this fact, and this doesn't actually line up with what you believe about the world. There's no way that Christianity could have started the way it did if your worldview is true. The only thing that explains it is the resurrection, and that doesn't fit with your worldview either. So you've got a problem. And what you need to do is to listen to this other story. This is biblical Christianity's story about how the world got here, about what happened, and you need to make a leap of faith. So you have this combination of this acknowledgement of how central faith is, of how central story is, along with a very rigorous academic approach to knowledge as well. The two things go together. And N.T. Wright doesn't try to, he doesn't make this point about the resurrection and then start from scratch. He doesn't, obviously not a quasi-postmodernist approach. But he wants to say this busts up your worldview. It doesn't work. You need to choose, you know, what you're going to do in response to that. So that's a example of material data. Yeah.
Well, I was noticing that the quasi-modern thing seems to be
Yeah, someone who's coming from that viewpoint. And that's been sort of the interesting thing about how Smith and how I think some of there's a group called the Radical Orthodoxy Movement have essentially said that what the church needs to do is to push people who are in the quasi-postmodernism camp first to become more postmodern. He says they're essentially being too modernist still because they're saying, you know, we can't really know it unless we have this certainty. And they're saying, come on, that's not how you live your life. I mean, this is something we talk about. You know, you don't look for this sort of objective, mathematical, scientific certainty on everything before you act. That's just not how we know the world. You need to, you know, incorporate that into your theory of knowledge and of history. And you know, again, in arguing, and Joel Garver does this, that this is how humans and Christians especially have wrestled with these things, that it's been much more in line with a thorough postmodernism. So, part of the issue is dealing with what's interesting is you have that here. I think when we get to the other two types of data, there's more potential for someone who, in spite of their quasi-postmodernism view, can still be shifted over some. So let me talk about those. So another one is value-based data. And this is something, Tim Keller does this a lot, and I think it's because he's probably has increasingly postmodern, you know, influenced congregation, and this works very well for them. So you look at value-based data, and what I'm drawing this from, this is a few people have done this, but I mentioned Thomas Nagel's book, Mind and Cosmos. He does this in his book as well, so I'll use his model for it. He basically, he's not a Christian, he's a philosopher at NYU, and he has the subtitle of the book, I didn't write it down, is something like Why the Neo-Darwinian View of the World is Almost Certainly False. He's arguing against a materialist Darwinian view of the universe. Not from a Christian, not from any sort of regular theist point of view, but on philosophical grounds saying he doesn't think it's true. And he brings a bunch of arguments that are really interesting, but one of them is about value. And what he essentially says is, look, I think human beings have more value than rocks do. They just do. I think a human life matters more than the life of a rock. If this sort of scientific materialism view is right, if people are just, you know, sacks of chemical reactions that happen to develop over time because they, you know, replicated themselves, they don't really have any value. They're just a thing that happened. Our lives don't really matter. Our children don't really have any more value than a rock or a mountain or anything else, a tree. And Nagel basically says, I don't think that can be true. One of these things is true and one is false. They can't go together. Either, you know, The neo-Darwinian view of everything's just an accident is true and people have no value, or people have value and we need a different explanation of where the world came from, because this one's not going to work. So Nagel puts forth that argument. It's sad because he doesn't know where to jump after that. He knows he has to leap off of the, and he's not willing to stand on scientific materialism any longer, but he doesn't really know where he's going to jump. He essentially says, I don't believe that there's a God, and that is because I don't want there to be a God. It's a very small book, and he's remarkably honest. He basically says, it's my intellectual preference to, that there's no God, so I'm gonna go with that. He's very open about the fact that it's not based on any sort of argument, or anything like that. He just doesn't want it to be true. So it's sad. He doesn't know where to go, but he knows we need to go somewhere. He kind of says, hopefully someone smarter than me one day will figure out where we go next. But he knows that there needs to be some sort of leap. But I think with especially a lot of more the relativistic type folks, there's often this funny split. And again, it's something Keller so helpfully points out. They, you know, will say they believe in what's essentially a scientific materialist view of the world, that, you know, we're all sort of here by accident and everything is relative, there's no real morals. And yet there's also usually, in the same people, you'll find a strong passion for social justice issues, for helping the poor. And he helpfully will sort of point out, you know, there's absolutely no logical reason to help people who are suffering if this view that you're advocating of the world is true. They're just, you know, things that happen to exist in the world right now. Why are you going to, you know, give yourself to help them? And rather than most people at a gut level believe those things about how humans have value much more strongly than they do the worldview that they're saying they believe. And so if really pushed to choose, they'll often be much more quick to give up on the worldview and look for something that seems more plausible. They can't get it out of them that humans have value. It takes a lot of work or depravity to really be thorough in your view that humans don't have any value. So I think especially with people who are sort of have a more quasi-postmodernism view, even though it doesn't really fit, there's still a gut level in which I think this can work. And the last one is what I'm calling relational data. And I like having this in here. I think it's helpful because there's often this pitting in discussions about evangelism about, you know, being relational versus the arguments and how do they really fit together. And I think it's helpful to remember that this sort of relational stuff can be data in a sense also that causes someone to convert. So, you know, a helpful story that comes up when people look at the early church is how Christians acted during the plagues and how this caused a lot of conversions. And I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name who wrote the book on the growth of early Christianity, but he focuses on this. And what he says is essentially, you had a plague would come into a town, into a city, and the pagans would flee. I mean, they would leave their friends behind who seemed sick. They would leave family members behind who seemed sick. They would get out of there to try to spare themselves. And the Christians often would stay. They would stay and care for not just their own sick people, but for the sick pagans as well. And this caused a shift in how people viewed the Christians. It caused a shift in how they viewed the world. Because from their worldview, from the worldview of ancient paganism, you know, Christians were bad. They were delusional. They were atheists. They, were not good people. And yet here they were loving other pagans better than those pagans' family members were loving them. They were sacrificing themselves in ways that other pagans weren't. And if these people are so crazy, if they're so bad, why would they do this? There's an understanding of what Christians are and how people work in ancient paganism that doesn't really make sense of Christians' behavior during the plagues, at least for many of them. Whereas the view of biblical Christianity did make sense to say, we're doing this because of what God has done for us. This is how we see the world. It made sense of the Christians' behavior. And so a lot of conversions early on were because of these actions, these relational things that happened with other Christians. And so we have relational data. And so, you know, that concept of building relationships with non-Christians and just loving them, that's not just something we do because we hope we'll kind of soften them up and, you know, by being really nice to them, and then they'll hear us at some point. But it's actually input into their understanding of the world. It, you know, if they're not a Christian, then usually the way that, you know, other Christians loving them doesn't fit very well with their worldview, especially loving them better than people who see the world the way that they do. And so when we do that, we're really challenging their worldview, even if we're not engaging in any sort of arguments. You know, showing Christ forth in our actions has a big role in this. And, you know, that was interesting just coming, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, coming from the Sacred Road mission trip to see that at work, to see kids whose understanding of the world has shifted radically just because they were being loved by Christians. I mean, they talked about one of the houses they worked on early on, this elderly woman whose house was sort of a mess, and this team came up from Alabama or something like that and spent a week, and they brought all the shingles and they roofed her house and did all this stuff, and she wasn't a Christian. And she was kind of avoided them for most of the time they were doing it, and she came out the last day and talked to Chris Granberry, the pastor there, and he told us a story with tears in her eyes saying, why are you doing this? My family lives nearby and they wouldn't do this for me. Why are you loving me better than my family does? Their understanding, you know, her understanding of the world, and especially on the, you know, the role that family would play, didn't have an answer. There was something that put a hole in her worldview that Christians would come and love her that way. And so really those kind of acts also play a role in this. So that's where I want to leave us with something that I hope is a little bit positive in terms of how, you know, our concept of knowledge relates to faith, relates to stories. There's, I think, a number of ways that this helps us practically. One is just to take the burden off of ourselves. I feel like, it's not always, but some apologetics, we get into the tendency to feel like we have to build this logical argument for everything that we believe as Christians. And it's something we want to be working at. We want to be able to explain it. But most people don't convert to Christianity because, you know, they've read, you know, the Birkhoff systematics, and there's been, you know, we need Birkhoff systematics, but its main role is not going to be in convincing, you know, a materialistic atheist that, you know, this is all true by building it from scratch. So, you know, we can relieve ourselves a little bit of the burden to do that. And our role when we're sharing faith with others is actually a lot more like storytelling. You know, it's a lot more like what Morpheus did. We're saying, you know, we're saying, here's your story, and maybe we're asking, what is your story? You know, we had a couple classes on evangelism here a few weeks ago that focused a lot on asking people, what is the story by which you understand the world? Where things came from, where things are going, who God is, if he's anyone at all. We're hearing stories and then we're telling stories. And in fact, a lot of, I think it sometimes goes too far, but a lot of postmodern Christian thinkers have put it more in terms of the idea that really what evangelism needs to be is we're out narrating everyone else. Everyone in the world is telling a narrative. This is the world. This is how we got here. And we have our own story about the world and why it's here. And ours lines up with reality, which means it makes sense of a lot more than the other stories do. And so storytelling and telling the grand story of the scriptures has a major role. We can see data matters, but it's not the foundation. We have to remember that aspect of faith that's always going on in ourselves and in other people, that there's you know, this constant role of this story we believe by faith. It's reinforced by the data that we see. It's, you know, our faith is reinforced when we see things in the world that line up with what we already believe. It's helpful and encouraging, but it's not the foundation. And also just that relationship and values, those two categories matter a lot as well. That our apologetics needs to deal with those material things, but that there's a very serious relational component and a value component that's often already in place. That, you know, most non-Christians already believe certain things about what's right and wrong. And, you know, again, this is similar to an approach Lewis and a lot of others have taken in arguing for the faith, is starting with things that the other person already believes, that's consistent with the Christian worldview and often inconsistent with the worldview they're claiming. And as I said just a minute ago, that aspect of listening to what the people around us believe and helping them see the things that they already believe that are explained better by Christianity than by whatever worldview they're advocating. So these are ways I think that that this can be helpful for us. So I'm going to stop there because that's the end of it and because I'm out of time. So those are two good reasons. I'm going to ask for questions. I want to say one more thing before that. A couple people have talked to me about, there's been some discussion about the idea of starting what I guess we would call a philosophy club or something like that for people who have, I guess, either enjoyed this series or been frustrated by this series because they want to get into more of the detail than we could get into in a setting like this. So if that describes you, if you'd be interested in that, we were talking about the idea of meeting once a month to, I don't know what. I guess we would decide it once we saw who was interested, but be discussing certain topics or possibly reading something and having a discussion about it. We'll see what people want to do if they're interested. I'll send a TNT out about that as well, but if you're interested in that, please come talk to me and we'll get you on the list of people who we keep in the loop more about that as we go forward and think about it. So that's a thing I wanted to announce. And then are there any other thoughts or questions? Or yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I mean, Keller and, you know, obviously Francis Schaeffer, a lot of those guys in that tradition are really good with that, and yeah, that's great. I'm glad it fits well with that.